Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren. If you are new to the show, you might like to know that we cover and have covered a lot of varying topics over the 10 years that we've been doing the show. All kinds of things that we have been interested in. But as of right now, we are primarily focused on the struggle for European civilization and the European people as we face unprecedented pressure from mega-wealthy globalists and elites within our own countries that have decided that we are their enemies and that we should be replaced by foreign people in our own countries while calling it diversity. This goes beyond mere immigration. This is demographic replacement, and whoever notices this and opposes it is a hateful, racist, Nazi bigot. Despite some critiques of how the word has been presented and used in the mainstream, we could, for the sake of simplicity, say that we are more on the alt-right. Our website is redice.tv. We have a large archive for you there to dip into. Make sure that you do look around. Today we're speaking with Kevin Alfred Strom. We are going to hear about his work with the National Alliance, National Vanguard, and his show American Dissident Voices. He has had tremendous pressure from the outside and all kinds of accusations made against him and about him. I guess that kind of comes with the territory when you're talking about things that no one wants you to even notice. And so it's always good to hear directly from the source itself. And we on this show can give people an opportunity to tell us what they really are concerned with and how they currently see things instead of going to second and third hand sources that are write-ups in the lying press. Let's go over to our guest and hear about his concerns. Kevin Alfred Strom, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for taking some time off speaking with us today.
It's great to be here, Henrik.
Very good. So let's talk a bit about your background, if you don't mind, first. You have Norwegian roots. You are behind American Dissident Voices. You're part of the National Alliance and also run the National Vanguard website. For newcomers who might not be familiar with your work, can you maybe tell us a few words when you got involved in National Alliance and what your relationship was to William Pierce?
I first met William Pierce in 1982. I had been involved in alternative political groups for a few years before that, and I was at a meeting of a constitutionalist group run by a very nice lady, Edith Bradbury, in Alexandria, Virginia, in about 1981, I guess, and I got a copy of a newspaper called Attack. And Attack was then the tabloid newspaper put out by the National Alliance, edited by William Pierce, and I was very favorably impressed and eventually called the Alliance. I spoke to Dr. Pierce's secretary, Rosemary Rickey, and arranged to meet Dr. Pierce, and that was the beginning of our relationship in 1982.
So what pulled you in that direction to begin with? I mean, what, if you don't mind, tell us what kind of prompted you to start thinking in the terms that and the issues and the problems that National Alliance address?
I suppose it all began, if you want to go all the way back, when I was about 12 years old in junior high school. I had several experiences that led me to believe that some of the things I was being told in the newspapers and on the television weren't true. One of those things was the ongoing chaos in the streets of America over the Civil Rights Revolution and the Vietnam War. I'll deal with the Vietnam War first. The protests at that time against the war weren't just against the war because the Vietnam War was bad for American interests. It was killing Americans unnecessarily. It wasn't really like that. The leaders of these protests were openly in favor of the victory of the communists. And some of these protests were rather violent. And it seemed very odd to me, even at the age of 12, that the leading lights, many of the leading lights of the establishment, people who were in the media, the commentators, the newscasters, the editorial writers at the time, actually seemed to be supporting these rioting Marxist demonstrators. And I just, something inside me said, something is very strange about this. Here's a group of people who are announcing they support Marxism, are announcing they want the overthrow of the current establishment, and yet spokesmen for that current establishment are saying, we sympathize with these protesters. We in some cases, we support them. and the newspaper coverage was very favorable to these protesters, and I didn't understand. I wanted to understand. And so that was my first intimation that something very strange was going on in my country. And, of course, I just had a kid's understanding of it. Around the same period of time, I had a teacher named Frank Herlihy. And Mr. Herlihy was a really extraordinarily good teacher on every level. He was a Virginia history teacher, and I had him for 2 years in junior high school. And he opened my eyes to so many things. He encouraged us to read serious books, even though we're just 12 and 13-year-old kids. He encouraged us to look at alternate views of history. He had revisionist materials. He had Western Destiny magazine. He had the American Mercury magazine. He had the Washington Observer, which was Willis Carto's publication at the time, in the classroom, along with other newspapers and magazines with a more establishment or even sometimes a leftist point of view. But he encouraged us to think about these things. And I think my friendship and with Mr. Herlihy and the mentoring I got from him was a big factor in my beginning to realize some things that have been very powerful forces in my life. And one of the things Mr. Herlihy told me about was that this civil rights agitation is not what it appears to be. And that was really the beginning.
Well, was he ever found out, the teacher?
No. My understanding is that he retired after a long and successful career, and in Virginia in the 1960s, perhaps he was able to get away with that. I think that today it would be a different story, unfortunately.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of what's that movie that was, I think, out of Canada. Was it Danger in Little Spring Rock or something? I forget the title now, but it was about the story of a teacher who basically was teaching some of the revisionist material to the students. And of course, the movie depicted it as it was kind of creating some kind of cult or something. It reminds me of that kind of a similar scenario, you know, in the fact that sometimes, occasionally, you do get teachers that actually really stand out in that way, and they really manage to offer, you know, their students something different, which completely kind of turned their world upside down in one way or another. Very good thing.
And there was another teacher who influenced me, but he really only influenced me profoundly on the very last day of high school. And I graduated from high school in 1974. And Mr. Malone was a science teacher, and he was a rather good science teacher. On the very last day of school, there's really not much to do. You're talking with your friends. You're talking in a friendly way with the teacher about your future plans for life. And all the exams are over. And so it's a very relaxed atmosphere. Well, on comes an announcement over the PA system in our high school. And I think they periodically had announcements by some of the students. And in between the announcements, and they had more than usual on that day because it was the last day of school, they would let the students play music occasionally. On comes this song over the PA system, and it's, I think it's called, I've forgotten the name of it. I think it may be Louie. It's Brother Louie, that's right. Brother Louie by the Stories. And this was a song about racial mixing. It was about an interracial couple, and the song portrayed the relationship as a wonderful thing. But Mr. Malone went over to the speaker and had a switch on it, and he cut it off, and he says, "I'm not going to listen to that garbage in my classroom." And everybody was stunned because he'd never been a very emotional person before, and he was really angry. And he explained to the class in it was a restrained tone, but you could tell there was a lot of emotion behind it. He said that these people who put this stuff out, what they want is amalgamation of the races. They want to destroy you. They want to destroy everything you stand for, and I will not have that in my classroom. And it was, even though Mr. Herlihy had encouraged me to look at the things in a different way, I hadn't really looked at it in a starkly racial way. So even I was dumbfounded, and it forced me to think. And I didn't say anything at the time, but the seed was planted, and many seeds were planted over the years. I could go into more. Even when I was 7 years old, I even though I didn't really think about race when I was 7 years old, that's when my family first came to the Washington, D.C. area. And I was unbelievably impressed by the beautiful classical architecture and statuary in that city.
Yeah.
And I had a thought, like, I'm a part of this. I'm a part of something great. This is something beautiful. It just resonated in me. And I think that was another seed that was planted that led me to where I am today.
Very good. Yeah, and, you know, many don't wake up to these issues at all. In fact, they go in the opposite direction. They end up, you know, fighting these kinds of arguments. We can talk a bit more about that later. And by the way, for those of you out there listening, the movie I was thinking about was called Evil in Clear River from 1988. It's a pretty good movie. It actually depicts, you know, this Canadian, you know, teacher and how the kind of the community reacts. And of course, it's very skewed, the movie. It's very, you know, it's telling it from, you know, this perspective that he's evil and all this kind of stuff. But it's actually a pretty good depiction. But why don't we talk a bit about your kind of, I guess if there's a way that you can give us kind of an overview to the framework of your perspective, if you will. If you would to explain to someone who hasn't heard about your work before, how would you present the image of how you see the world today in terms of the problems that we are facing and the concerns that you see in our world, if you can? I know it's a big question, but kind of like an overview so we can get an insight into how you think a little bit, Kevin.
Well, we live in a world, we live in a universe that's evolving. And it always has been evolving, and it always will evolve. And we, too, like all life on planet Earth, are evolving. We're evolving into something beyond what we are now. And once you see the world from an evolutionary perspective, once you see that all of life is branching and moving upward in evolutionary grade, and those that do not do that do not continue to live in this universe. Once you see that picture, then you understand what race, culture, and civilizations are all about. And that's about as broad as I can make it.
Now, you did one of the things that I like about some of your work as well is that you expanded beyond just the, you know, the political, beyond just the you know, the kind of more, it's not mundane by any means, but it's of course more, you know, temporary issues, and you expanded into kind of eternal questions of philosophy and what's the purpose. You've even spoken quite a bit about, you know, maybe our destiny going into space, going to different planets and these kinds of aspects, which is very, very interesting. You did a two-part recently on the issue of entropy. It kind of goes a little bit along with what you're talking about over this fact that we're constantly fighting against kind of a natural form of degradation. Everything is slowly slowing down and breaking down, and we as human beings and as life overall is there in that process of kind of, you know, resisting that to a certain extent. And I find it really interesting listening to that because it takes it into a much bigger picture than just speaking about, you know, demographics or, you know, human biodiversity, that there's a larger and much bigger aspect to this and to what we are part of and to the, you know, the legacy of philosophy and civilization that we carry as well. So it's a very important and big, you know, question at the same time in regards to, you know, if we lose Western civilization, if we lose European people overall, how many are going to carry the torch of the philosophical tradition? How many are going to carry the torch of, you know, space exploration and going to those extra extent that goes kind of beyond just the biological needs? Don't you agree?
I do agree. And I think if the European race does not survive, it is quite possible that life will eventually simply end and there will be no more, because life on Earth is very limited. In time, it is not going to go on forever. We have to become, as Elon Musk says, an interplanetary species if we're going to survive. And I think that the survival of the European race is essential for that to happen. In my series that you referred to, the White Race and the Arrow of Time, in part two of that series, I brought forward a couple of graphs from Charles Murray's book, Human Accomplishment. And those graphs show quite dramatically how important it is that our race survive. It shows the scientific accomplishments over the last several millennia and the significant figures in scientific accomplishment over the same time period. And then it breaks it down over which continents, which peoples of those continents contributed. And in both significant figures and in significant accomplishments, Europe and European-descended people in North America contributed 97% of those accomplishments. And most of the remaining 3% were from the ancient Western world. In other words, they broke that down further and said the ancient Western world is a separate category. So most of the remaining 3% was also Europeans. And there were some contributions from the Arab world. There were some contributions from East Asia, but they were minuscule in comparison. And we are in a situation where our planet is not going to have fossil fuels forever. Our chances of maintaining this technology is limited in time. We cannot continue a technological civilization forever. If we're going to escape the bounds of Earth, we have to do it soon. There's no chance that if the European race is destroyed and our whatever it is about us, that special combination of intelligence and creativity that gives us that 97 to 99%, whatever that is may well die. And before any other race would have time over millennia to achieve what we have done, to get back to the point of intelligence and creativity that we have, if they could do that, the fossil fuels will have long since run out and technological civilization will be impossible and journeys to other worlds and to other star systems will be impossible. So it is absolutely imperative that our race survive.
Yeah, it's a very scary thought, to be honest, on many different levels. Let's talk a bit about then what you see happening right now, both in America and Europe with mass immigration, with the promotion of diversity as the greatest thing ever, the lobbying for open borders. It's really a development of a cultural framework that states that this is moral, this is virtuous to have this kind of policy. And of course, we've seen on the flip side of that tremendous consequences, specifically in Europe, but also in America, of course, of terrorism, of a society that goes from being very high trust and a well-defined system of commons to basically falling apart. I think my country, Sweden, is a perfect example to that. I always bring it up to point to the fact that there's a tremendous change that have happened together right alongside the demographic change in the last 30 years or so. How would you describe this and what exactly it is that we're facing right now with the demographic change that's going on all over the countries founded and built by European people?
In my opinion, we are facing a deliberate attempt to exterminate our race. I believe that we are being genocided by a largely Jewish power elite that has created an inverted morality, which in all important respects is really the opposite of a proper morality, the morality that we instinctively would gravitate to if we had the right to form our own laws and institutions in our societies that were truly our own. And this inverted morality, whether it be promotion of mass immigration, whether it be promotion of convenience abortion, whether it be a promotion of wealth transfers to the non-white minority populations, the promotion of feminism, you can really understand where it's all coming from if you just stand back from it and see that this everything about this inverted morality is designed to minimize or actually prevent the births of white children. And everything that inverted morality is for tends to militate against more white children. And anything that is for more white children is regarded as evil by this inverted morality. And it's a morality that we simply will not survive if we continue to embrace it.
What do you think the reasoning is behind this? I mean, we address this question all the time on the show. Are we seen as an enemy? I mean, I think at this stage, you know, Kevin, most white people, most Europeans, they don't have an ethnic consciousness at all. They don't even think, truly, I don't think they think in these terms. It's almost that the recent change that we've seen with identity politics and all these kinds of things, that has kind of pushed white people into a perspective where they have been forced to think about these questions or address it for the first time because they have been charged with crimes of being racist, for example, just for being white, you know, for example. So to a certain extent, we've been cornered, right? But what do you think is the reasoning? I return to that point again. Are we seen as a competitor, as an enemy, or what drives our enemies, do you think?
I think the enemies of the white race include a lot of white people, obviously, and I think these people have accepted this morality. I think many, many people in every society, not just white societies, but in every society, are followers. They have to be. If you had all leaders, you would have chaos. You have to have leaders and followers. And unfortunately, the last few generations, including my generation, grew up under this inverted morality. They were taught that we must have a multicultural society, that it is somehow unfair, it's mean, it's even evil to have a society just for whites. That's evil. However, I don't think that white people are really the driving force behind this inverted morality. I think the Jewish minority, the Jewish power structure, who are the world's richest and most powerful ethnic group on planet Earth, designed this morality specifically to keep us under control. And if it happens to exterminate us and to make the world safe for them and their way of life, they don't care. And they are, I think they had big trouble in Germany during World War II. I think that the German people were freed from their influence, and I believe there was a tremendous, obviously everybody who reads history books from any point of view knows there was a tremendous conflict between the National Socialist Germany and the Jews, and they don't want to take a chance on that happening again. And so they've doubled down on their anti-white, anti-racial, and really when it comes down to it, they might not describe it this way, anti-evolutionary morality that they are imposing on us. And I believe that they have their own interests in doing so. They are a parasitic people. They are nomadic. They exist by living in other people's countries. And until very recently, they did not have their own country. And they, because of that, they are constantly a minority in someone else's land. And it is much safer for a minority group, particularly a minority group that wants to make a great deal of money and hold power behind the throne, to be one of many minority groups. If you're the only minority group, you really stand out. And
right,
that can be dangerous to them. So they prefer to be one of many minorities. They feel safer under those circumstances. And I also think there's a biological evolutionary factor. They evolved as a wandering people. If you read the Hebrew Bible, their own myths show them as a wandering people. And they've always been a wandering people, as far as history knows them, among other peoples. And they evolved in that environment. Well, it's a truism that many, many animals, many, many living creatures in this world modify their environments to best suit them. And so I believe that on an unconscious level, to some extent, biologically, instinctively, and also at the highest levels, using their conscious minds, they are modifying their environment to suit their way of life. And that involves, unfortunately for us, destroying the racial integrity of our societies, and that will prove fatal to us.
Yeah, this is interesting. You know, being a roaming people in that regard has been a tremendous downside for the longest time, but somehow they managed to transform the world, really, into a globalized world that we unfortunately have today, where they've taken advantage of this very aspect. But it seems, what's interesting too, Kevin, is that it seems that it's not enough to maybe stand behind then when we had the creation of Israel, and you'd think that this problem of sorts would have absolved itself. It would have been easier at that point and to say, okay, we have a country now, we have a homeland of our own, we can go there. But that hasn't happened really, right? There's still a very strong ethnic cohesion of these people within our own countries to still lobby for the destruction of our countries, like we can see with Barbara Spector, for example, in Sweden. And she's talking, of course, about all of Europe that needs to be multicultural. But this is an aspect which is interesting to me, because you think that it would be dangerous for them to a certain extent to push so hard that they have done, because look at the results now. I think we can see that people are actually starting to wake up to this aspect, where they before, as I said earlier, didn't even have a clue about these kinds of things. We weren't raised thinking about these issues. We weren't brought up to even consider race and these kinds of things. And today, coinciding, of course, with the rise of the alt-right and everything, we're seeing more and more people coming to the realization that, you know, human biodiversity matters, there are race differences, and that someone is out to get us. And this is isn't that a risk that they're taking to a certain extent, of pushing so hard that they have done? And this is something that, you know, will put them in a situation where they will be, charged and accused with these crimes against European people.
That seems to be the pattern of Jewish existence: peak and crash. But now it's not just peaking in England and getting thrown out of England, or peaking in Portugal and getting thrown out of Portugal. It's peaking in the world in terms of power and wealth, and angering many, many peoples in the process, and maybe getting thrown out of the world. It really seems to be all or nothing for them. They do not seem to be a people that can accept a position of reasonable profit and reasonable power and relax and enjoy the fruits of it. They seem to always be pushing. And the Zionist project seems to contradict their own psychology. In other words, they don't have a history of living in their, just Bible myths to the contrary, they don't have a history of living in their own country and subsisting by living off the land and having a self-contained economy. They have a history of living off other people. And so perhaps instinctively, unconsciously to some extent, they won't go to Israel in any really large and significant numbers. Only a tiny fraction of the Jewish population is in Israel now. And I also, how can they abandon their positions of power? They have a money monopoly in Western Europe. They have a money monopoly in the United States and in most of the world. They are dominant in the banking and financial sectors. They are dominant in the media. This is a tremendous center of profit and power to them. Just saying, well, we'll just sell it all and go to Israel, just doesn't seem to be in their psyche. So I think once again, it's peak and crash. And they create their own crashes, really, by their own actions.
I mean, how do they pull this off? I mean, the transformation or the inversion of values, where we've ended up now in a situation where we resent our own people. We, to a certain extent, hate our own civilization, what we've been created. We've been led to believe that all we brought was, you know, colonialism and slavery and, you know, rape and pillage around all of the world. And we've gone from a position where we were, you know, proud of being part of who we were. We were proud of, you know, our ancestry. We wanted to uphold and make sure that we continued and preserved, you know, what our ancestors gave to us, etc., to this place where we are today, most of us, where we resent our own, where the self-hatred is so strong that most don't even seem to care about that at all. It was not something that happened overnight, obviously, but how do you think that was performed? How did they manage to do that?
I think that white people in general are people who respect authority. We, through our own psychological evolution, we developed a respect for our own leaders. We developed a society where we respected the town, the village elders or the tribe elders. We chose our own leaders in many of our societies, or in some cases we believed our leaders were divinely chosen. But in any case, we respected the elders, the leaders, the people who were the authorities in our societies. And I think when the Jewish minority came into our society, not only did they bring with them their own evolutionary legacy of being very, very highly verbally intelligent and able to be very, very persuasive. That's part of their survival strategy when they live among other peoples. But they also brought with them a realization that the new technologies that they saw that European man had invented, the printing press, the motion picture, radio, and eventually television, these things had replaced in many ways the authority of the village elders or the village council or the tribal council in the minds of European man. And they saw it was wide open. All you needed to take control of the nerve centers and information and apparent authority in a society was to buy newspapers and then later radio and film production studios. And they did that, and they have, to a large extent, my whole childhood was immersed in network television and the lives of everybody around me, but my generation and the generation before me was immersed in network television and major newspapers. This is where people got not only their ideas of what was happening in the world, but perhaps even more importantly, their ideas of what others were thinking. And the Jewish minority controlled that, and I think they found us a very naive people who had basically evolved for tens of thousands of years in the cold north where we had to trust each other to survive, and they found us very trusting and naive, and we believed the narrative they told us of their own suffering, of how they were a terribly persecuted people, and how we were very, very wrong to exclude them and, by extension, to exclude other races from our society. We bought into that. I think because most of us respect authority, and they had managed to get into a position of authority, sad to say.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've seen Hollywoodism is based on the book An Empire of Their Own by Neil Gabler, where they kind of describe what you're talking about in a very frank and open manner, actually, and it's not maybe about the world's media or the creation of the you know, entertainment industrial complex that we have today, but they specifically frame it in the context of how they did this in America, of basically, as they, you know, phrase it in the documentary, they talk about creating a shadow America, one that is basically a facsimile, a version which didn't really exist in the 1940s and 50s and onward. But that this vision that they invented of sorts and put on the silver screen eventually overtook, you know, what they call the real America. And it's quite interesting. It's very interesting of how, you know, kind of candid and open, of course, and they do it from a perspective where they think that this is something good. We injected our morality and our cultural values into America, and then kind of the rest of the world has followed on from this as a consequence, where the whole globe is you know, consuming Hollywood movies. It's pretty interesting. I don't know if you saw the documentary.
I have not seen it, but that's a very clever way of looking at it. And if you say it's coming from a Jewish source, then that's even more amazing, actually.
I'll send it to you. It's very interesting. As I said, Bill, you know, founded on the An Empire of Their Own, that book where they talk about the major studio heads that arose after they took off from New York. They were actually thrown out of New York because they were stealing Edison's technology, and they refused to pay licenses for it. So they actually took off to the West Coast to hide from what they say in the movie was Edison's thugs, right, that didn't want to give them the technology. So anyway, I'll send the link to you. Very, very interesting.
Thank you.
But what do you think is happening right now, though, with the media environment? We've seen a shift and a change with the dawn of the Internet, and we're seeing a much more aware people to these kinds of aspects that we're talking about, an awareness of globalism, an awareness of you know, this system of corrupt media. And we can get into Trump here a little bit later, but we even have, of course, a presidential candidate now that openly is addressing these issues using these words. I mean, I think it's tremendous. What do you think?
I think you've really hit on something there. Trump using those words. Of course, the National Alliance and other patriotic individuals in other countries, has been telling these truths for 30 or 40 years. But a lot of people who might agree with us and who were influenced by us, I think, have been afraid to speak out because they know how the system works. They know who controls the money. They know that the corporations and the politicians are intimidated by the media, and they know that they could easily lose their employment if they speak out in a way that is pro-white or that criticizes Jewish power or that in any way violates the taboos of political correctness that basically are the standards of this inverted morality that has been forced on us. So here we have Donald Trump. Now, I don't think Donald Trump is the solution. And I also don't think Donald Trump is one of us. I really think he's a multiracialist. I really think that his values are not our values, and he's not what we need. But Donald Trump is a frank guy who sees some of the more ridiculous, egregious things that are going on, and he just speaks frankly about them. He doesn't censor himself. I guess maybe it's his natural personality and reinforced by the fact that he's a man of considerable success and wealth, that in his own mind, I think he thinks that gives him the right to give orders and to say what he thinks, and the hell with the rest of the world. And that has caused two reactions. It has made the establishment very afraid of him, even though he's very tied in with the Jewish establishment. They're just afraid of him because he's a loose cannon and he tells the truth occasionally, and they hate people who tell the truth. And he's also his own man. He could turn on them in an instant and might. And they don't want to take that chance. Hence, almost all of the Jewish power structure and their employees in the media and in the Congress and in the Senate of the United States are against him. And but he has caused another effect among the people who used to be afraid to speak out. Like I said, many people are afraid of losing their employment. But, you know, if they just say something just a little bit more radical than one of the major presidential candidates, they figure that can't make me lose my job. Trump said almost the same thing yesterday. And right. Also, they're authority worshipers. Most people are, to some extent, authority worshipers. And here's a really huge authority figure, one of the leading businessmen in the United States and the candidate of one of the major parties who may well get in the White House, saying some of these things. He's saying, you know, some of those Mexican immigrants are really undesirable. We need to build a wall. if that makes him, and the media are screaming, you know, the Jewish power structure is screaming, he's virtually Hitler when he says that.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if a major political candidate can be virtually Hitler and yet get away with it, then the average person who's a little bit timid might say, well, maybe I can get away with a bit more, too. And I think it's really brought people out of the closet. And that's where you have this alt-right phenomenon. I don't really think there is an alt-right movement. I think that's just a name that has been attached to this phenomenon, this tsunami, really, of awakened people finally getting the courage to speak up. And it's infectious. It feeds on itself, and it's growing every day. I'm on Twitter a little bit myself, and I see it constantly. It grows endlessly. And these people, I'm so happy to finally see it happening. You call them a bigot, you call them a Nazi, you call them all kinds of names, and you know what they do? They don't cower and hide and say, oh, please don't call me that, I'm sorry, I apologize. They laugh.
That's right.
I've been waiting for that.
Yeah, it's true. You know, Trump is blazing a trail. I see that he's setting back those that have been pushing, you know, this narrative of political correctness, and he's, as you say, he's kind of blowing open a space which previously has been, you know, non-existent almost to a certain extent, where people can come into that space and feel, as you say, kind of freely to discuss some of these ideas again and address some of these issues. And it's interesting to see how quickly also that happened to a certain extent, how quickly many people got behind them. And I'm not saying, of course, that all of these people that support Trump share all of your values, for example, or all of mine. But nonetheless, Trump has, whether he wants to or not, become a kind of a symbol for that discontent, whether it's on a very, you know, low level, if you will, to one that's very high level in terms of, you know, how we see the world and the kind of the problems that we face. But I think that's excellent. I think it goes beyond just him as a presidential candidate. It goes to something much more deeper. And I think you mentioned this in one of your shows as well. You were talking about the fact that this is not the end. This is actually just the beginning of a kind of an awakening. And who knows where this will be? Well, obviously we have to see whether he gets in or not. But in even 5 to 10 years, this could have been growing into something which we can't even imagine today.
I agree with that, and I think it's going to happen whether or not Trump is elected. I think if he is elected, either he's going to move us in the direction that I want him to move us in, or he's not. And in fact, either of those two alternatives are still good, because if he does, of course, obviously that's good. If he will give us more years for the white resistance to organize and to grow and to educate more people. But if he doesn't, though, the number of supporters who think he's going to are going to be tremendously and profoundly disappointed and angry. And those people aren't just going to evaporate. That enthusiasm isn't just going to be stuffed back down into the rabbit hole. It can't be done. These people are going to coalesce, and some of them are going to see the fully radical vision of the National Alliance and William Pierce that I see and that I embrace. And I think the potential is infinite. And if Trump loses, again, there will be a tremendous anger. And this is the first time in my lifetime, at least that I remember, that any presidential candidate has said he may contest the results of the election. And you know what? Just because he said that, even if he doesn't, plenty of people are. And that is a major questioning of the entire structure, and that paves the way for revolutionary thinking, and that's what we need.
Yeah, very good. You know, I can understand to a certain extent why people maybe are, you know, suspicious of Trump and, you know, the people in his campaign, and are they genuine and all those kinds of questions. But the very fact that, you know, the globalist forces, from the bankers to the media industry and the entertainment industry, they have declared their hatred for him so prominently that in itself should be a sign to people that, you know, he's obviously a candidate which they don't like. And just to be able to realize that, okay, well, then he's doing something right. I mean, we can't compare this with, you know, how they pushed Obama on the scene in 2008, for example, how they promoted him as a messiah almost, as a kind of a savior. They are using all their ammunition, everything they have, to discredit Trump every single day and destroy his campaign and his candidacy. And that, I think, says to me that it's like, okay, well, this is interesting. This is unless that whole thing for some reasons would be a sham and they're just putting it on, it's just for show, then it means that, you know, he has something which they don't like, and that to me is reason enough to be supportive of him, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think it's all theater. He's made too many blunders for it to be theater. Hillary Clinton's speeches are theater. I don't think Trump's speeches are.
Right.
But
yeah.
I think that it is real. I think it's really happening. It's not theater. And I think he definitely has all the right enemies. They don't trust him. And so, therefore, there must be at least a few good things about him.
Yeah, that is true. Hey, let's talk a bit about National Alliance, and maybe you can explain to people, you know, what the organization is, what it does, and some of the things that you think people should know if they're new to it. We're going to, of course, continue to talk more about this in the second segment, but before we take a break, let's discuss that a bit and tell us what you think the audience should know about the organization.
The National Alliance began as the National Youth Alliance in 1970. 1974, Dr. Pierce changed the name to the National Alliance because it began as an organization for students and young people who were trying to fight against the countercultural anti-white movement of those times. The National Alliance is a group of white men and women from around the world. Most of our members are in the United States, but we are not restricted to the United States, who believe that the future is what we make it, and we are determined to be participants rather than spectators, and we stand for the not only the continued existence of the white race, but the fulfillment of the destiny of the white race in this universe. And we have printed publications every month. Our members receive the National Alliance Bulletin. We have a online news magazine, National Vanguard, which is at nationalvanguard.org. We have a membership website at natall.com. We also have a community in the state of West Virginia in the Allegheny Mountains, a little bit south of me. I'm in the Allegheny Mountains of western Pennsylvania, but a few hundred miles south of me, we have an intentional white community in the mountains of West Virginia. And we are trying to build that up to be a place where our members and activists can eventually form the nucleus of a viable community and eventually a new society.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, there's a lot to discuss there, of course, in itself. And I wanted to, maybe we can do that in the next segment, talk a bit more about, you know, how that's going and if that's kind of as a future model of that thing. But tell us a bit more about just kind of the ideology. I don't think you exclude people per se, but it's not like a Christian organization, right? It has some roots in pre-Christian tradition, if I understand that correct.
Well, the symbol of the National Alliance is a letter from the runic alphabet of the Germanic peoples. We call it the life rune. It's also been called the man rune, and it's a symbol of a life and upward ascendant life, upwardly evolving life. And no, we're not a Christian organization. We do have some Christian members, but they are Christian members who put race first. The purpose of the National Alliance is to advance the survival and the interests and the upward evolution of the white race. And we believe we need a completely new society based on completely new principles in order to do that. And the leading figures in the alliance are adherents of the religion of cosmotheism, which was also founded by the same man who founded the alliance, a physics professor named Dr. William Pierce. And that is the spiritual basis for our political work.
Now, what are some of the things that, you know, yourself and William Pierce have been fighting against over the years? I know that there's been not only, of course, a struggle to wake people up, but there's been kind of an information war, if you will, of sorts on top of that. There's been accusations, attempt to discredit. There's been, everything, as far as I could tell, to try to smear the group as much as possible to, I guess, just make sure that people stay away from it. Isn't that right?
There seems to be that kind of activity against any truly effective force for white renewal or white identity. The government will engage in dirty tricks. The intelligence agencies, whether they be private intelligence agencies like the Southern Poverty Law Center or national intelligence agencies, have very, very large budgets, unaudited budgets, to send in infiltrators, to hire media hacks, to spread rumors and false stories in the media and make us look like a bunch of degenerate criminals, and to try to break up the groups. In fact, I believe Heidi Beirich of the Southern Poverty Law Center recently said in an interview on PBS that's what we do. We try to break up these groups. We try to shut them down. They don't try to debate us. They know that we're correct. They know our ideas are powerful. Their strategy is to shut us down, and I believe that government agencies have followed basically the same tactic. There was a program back in the 1960s that was exposed 10 or 20 years later, the COINTELPRO program, in which the Federal Bureau of Investigation infiltrated radical political groups, both left and right, and tried to steer them in directions that would destroy them. They tried to cause infighting between people who ought to have been allies. They spread rumors of sexual misbehavior or criminal activity. They actually incited criminal activity in some cases, and then reaped the quote-unquote benefit of destroying the groups that were then either their leaders were imprisoned or they were involved in ruinous civil actions because of the criminal activity that was actually incited by the government. And so basically, just as in wartime, no dirty trick or tactic is off the table when you're fighting a war. Governments do that sort of thing all the time, and it's expected. They have the same kind of attitude, both the government in the United States and certainly in other countries as well, and these private intelligence and dirty tricks organizations that the Jews operate. They have no compunction against using anything to stop us, because I think really part of the strategy of our enemies and the people they employ in the government is to save the magic of racial nationalism for themselves only. That's really what the political correctness amounts to. It's racial nationalism for them, for the Jews, but we are forbidden to have racial nationalism, and so they want to destroy us. So yes, endless dirty tricks. I could go on for hours.
Yeah, I remember we did a review of Imperium, the movie that actually shows some of this. I think it was Michael German was the intelligence guy's name. He would, I mean, it seems that they have an endless amount of resources and time and even willpower to spend on this, where they think that, you know, most of these people are radical terrorists. They're going to blow up buildings. You know, they're all Timothy McVeigh. So they create these sting operations where they have, and frankly, they've done this to some aspects and some portions of those elements within Islam as well that they consider to be, you know, maybe radicalized. They basically hand them weapons and resources and everything else, and then they're waiting for a guy basically to be convinced into pushing a button, right? And before that happens, they arrest a guy, or they, you know, they do a mass arrest or something like that. But it's basically, you know, a sting operation to incite people into this aspect of it. And I wonder too if these things ever would be the case if the government wasn't there providing, you know, resource and material and ideological, you know, convincing people ideologically to go in that direction and things like that.
Well, one example of that was a man named Hal Turner, who, like me and like you, has had a radio show for many years that ostensibly was a very radical pro-white radio program. He was based out of New Jersey, and he was famous for his wild, over-the-top rhetoric. He would very strongly hint at, if not actually call for, violent action against people who were hurting the white race. He even hinted that certain judges that had ruled, allegedly ruled against a pro-white organization should no longer be alive on planet Earth. And that eventually brought him to grief. But he also, for a time, he tried to submit articles to nationalvanguard.org. I think I printed one or two of them that were reasonably accurate. But his articles, I began to distrust him when I found out that I was fact checking the articles he sent to me, that he was wildly exaggerating some of the things he was saying in the articles. And so I sort of shied away from him, and thank God I did, because if I had maintained a close relationship with him, people in the National Alliance might have thought he was a fine guy and gotten to know him and contacted him, helped him with his radio show. And I'm glad that that didn't happen, because it turned out that he was all along working for the federal government and was paid by the FBI over $100,000 to entrap white Americans into committing crimes, and furthermore, even if he couldn't entrap them into committing crimes, putting their names in a database of people who should be observed. And so this, I'm sure he was exposed by chance because his handlers turned on him. Now, why exactly his handlers turned on him and sent him to prison, I don't know the answer to that question. But if he was exposed, I am sure that he's the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, today it seems that they're more concerned with white people who have a concern about being, you know, racially, demographically displaced and replaced in their own countries than they do for Islamic terrorism, for example. I mean, it's remarkable, isn't it?
Yes, indeed, it is.
All right, well, let's talk more about this, and of course, much more in the second segment. I want to get into much more with you, Kevin. But give us some of the websites. You mentioned, of course, National Alliance, National Vanguard. You have your own personal website. Let us know where people can go to read more.
Well, if you want to learn the core beliefs and principles of the National Alliance, you should read the articles that are up at natall.com. That's NATALL.com. That is our main organizational website. There you will be able to purchase the speeches of our founder, William Pierce, on CD. You will be able to read our foundational documents, and I think it will give you a very full understanding of where we stand and where we're coming from. Also, if there's a contact form there, if people would like to write to me, I will be happy to answer their questions, or if I can't answer them, I'll pass them along to our chairman, Will Williams. We also have a news magazine site, nationalvanguard.org. That's all one word, nationalvanguard.org.
All right, very good. Don't miss Kevin's show as well, American Dissident Voices. Is that once a week?
Yes, I have a weekly radio program, American Dissident Voices, and you can see the last 10 episodes of that right on the front page of nationalvanguard.org.
All right, very good. We'll have the links up to the websites that Kevin mentioned. Do check it out. We'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us. We'll be right back with the second segment. The second segment is coming up here, folks, so make sure you don't miss it. We have much more to talk about with Kevin and about his concerns and what we can do to shift things around. RedIceMembers.com is the website where you can tune into the second hour of this and all previous shows that we've done. We have videos, weekend live shows, films, and other video audio material for you there. We are doing a major overhaul of the members' website right now as well. But do make sure you support us. We are 100% independent. We are listener and viewer supported. Please help us grow in our coverage so that we can expand into a television channel. A membership is only €6 per month. That's just about $6.50 in US dollars. And we have subscriptions from 3 months up to 2 years available. Upcoming on the show, we have Ryan Laundrie, John Lash, and Chris DeLamo, to name a few. In terms of live streams, we are not doing one this weekend. We're actually very busy preparing for election night coverage. That's on November 8th. We have a bunch of people joining in during the evening. Kevin McDonald, Jared Taylor, James Edwards, and many others dropping by to give us their reactions as results are coming in on November 8th. We're also preparing for MPI in Washington, D.C. We'll bring you the entire conference live at the middle of November. More information about this will be posted on the website. Check redice.tv/live. But we'll be right back. More coming up with Kevin Alfred Strom. Please stay with us. RedIceMembers.com. Thank you so much for listening.